From KALW and PRX, I'm Lauren Schiller, and this is Inflection Point, stories of how women rise up. I have a special episode for you today. This fall, I was invited to moderate a panel for a conference put on by Women in Product. They're a nonprofit formed to create a strong community of women builders and leaders in the tech industry. My panel included four female founders of technology companies. There was Cheryl Conti of Fission Strategy, Heather Fernandez of Solve, Selena Tabakawala of Evite and Gixo, and Arti Ramamurthy of Lumioid. When I walked into the main area of the San Jose Convention Center, the room had an energy you could practically taste. Also, it was lunchtime. It was surreal, a tech conference with not a man in sight. The typical scenario is a large hall with white guys everywhere, giving you, the female attendee, the once-over, whether it's, will she buy my product or will she have a drink with me? None of that here. And unlike most other conferences I've been to, there was a makeup booth, a photographer offering headshots, and a lounge area with puffy white couches where women watched an entrepreneur demonstrating the power of a new product she'd invented. A briefcase meets purse meets backpack. So yeah, some girly stuff. But there is something about bringing together a whole lot of powerful, ambitious women in one place, where they can feel free from interruptions, mansplaining, and awkward gender-based power dynamics. And on the panel that I led, the speakers did not hold back. We talked about what surprised them about starting a company, the pros and cons of running a company while female, from leadership style to sexual harassment and gender bias, and ultimately, as business people, what it takes to scale. This panel took place on September 19th, 2017, and we had a full house. I asked the panelists what most surprised them in starting their companies. Here's Selena Tabakawala of Evite and now founder of Gixo.
So it's interesting because, you know, the first time around, I had nothing to be surprised about because everything was a surprise. It was like my first job, my first co-founder, first company, first time doing everything. And so we started Gixo with my same co-founder from Evite 20 years ago, which is quite an interesting journey. But, you know, I think the thing I was thinking was, okay, now I'm coming in with all this experience. You know, I was the president of SurveyMonkey. I ran international for Ticketmaster. Like, I'm walking in with so much of this experience. Like, it'll be, you know, it won't be as exciting and invigorating in the same way because I've seen so much. And that just hasn't been true. The last year and a half has been absolutely fantastic. Like, you're learning at such a rapid pace when you're doing a startup. Like, I'd never done mobile. I'd never actually led the fundraising. Like, there are all these things. I've never, you know, I hadn't really done a lot of the stuff of building a brand. And so suddenly you're back to this, like, learning so fast. And it's been such an amazing surprise.
Here's Cheryl Conti, the co-founder and CEO of Fission Strategy.
You know, I had founded other things before, you know, the tech startup. And, you know, for me, what was surprising was what an emotional roller coaster it was. I mean, literally every day, there'd be a moment where I would say, oh, I'm going to be rich. Like, we are all going to be so rich. We're going to make a difference, but also we're going to make money. And then, you know, the next day, they would be like, it's over. Like, we ran our course. Like, this was great. You know, and hopefully we inspired some ladies to do this. I don't know. I mean, it's just like, literally, it's very much, and you have to be prepared for that. I mean, that takes a lot of personal fortitude, you know, to get through those moments, you know, and know that you can make it no matter which way you end up. We ended up actually somewhere in the middle of that at the end once we were acquired, you know, but know that no matter how that story ends for you, that maybe it's the next day, that you're still a good person, that you still made a difference and that you still contributed. And that software and that learning, you know, is actually going to empower others and yourself in the next venture.
Well, this makes me wonder about how you create a healthy culture under all that stress, right? And you've all been through the ringer on a number of fronts in terms of
firstly, what's the idea? Secondly, pitching it. Thirdly, getting the money. Fourthly, building up your team. But as you build up your team and you run into people who aren't necessarily the right fit, and you realize that hopefully quickly, but maybe not sometimes all the time, how do you create the culture that you want? Because you're in charge now, right? And you're not subjected to someone else's idea. How do you create the culture that you want and then build on it?
So,
Selena.
I would say the most important thing is to be very deliberate about creating the culture you want. So day one of GICSO, Al and I sat on a whiteboard and started to write out what were the important tenets to us in building a culture. And then the second piece to that is, what does that actually mean in practice? So this is one of the many, many, many things I learned from Dave Goldberg, who is our CEO at SurveyMonkey. But he always used to say is, we have to think about not just what we want to do, but what does it actually mean underneath it? So I'll give an example, which is sometimes controversial, but people always say diversity is really important. But are you willing to put out marketing ads that are non-diverse that perform worse? Like, you know, like, no matter, I've tested up the wazoo, blonde white women perform better. And so I think there is this question, which is, what does that mean for your culture? Like, if it's an important tenet to you, how does that actually reflect down in the policy? Oh, we want to be a team-oriented culture. Well, then some of your compensation should be based on, does the team succeed? So it's really taking that next level down. So everybody will say one thing after the other in terms of, these are important things, have integrity, have X. But I think the question is, if this situation were to happen, how do we want to deal with it? And actually having those conversations with your executive team, with your co-founder.
And I'll just add to that, being willing to fire when there's not a good fit.
Mm-hmm. And here's Heather Fernandez, the founder of Solve.
You know, and I think, like Selena, having the benefit of having built a company where I didn't know that the first time around. I started early at Trulia, and we built that from a very irrelevant website with a handful of people to something that was quite meaningful. Realizing how painful it is when you have a bad culture fit, even though a really strong performer, it's much easier to cut it off early, right? And so defining those values, we did something very similar. You know, in fact, before we even had the idea, my co-founder Daniele
and I,
we actually had to stop ourselves. Because we're like, we should make sure we have a company to build before we articulate a culture. But it's sort of, one, having a co-founder that has that shared belief that the company culture and the company that you build is really important. It's critical to its success. And then making sure that you're aligned on what that is, I think is pretty important.
And Aarti Ramamurthy, who launched her company Lumio in 2014.
I think I would, just to add to Selena's and Heather's points, I think all of that verbatim, true, take culture seriously, start on day one. I mean, I didn't, and I kind of sort of paid for it down the road. So it's something that everyone kind of talks about, especially in Silicon Valley. It's like culture is important, culture is great, culture is critical. But I think I don't really believe that a lot of new startups take it really seriously. But please do. If you're ever thinking of starting a company, figure out what you want the culture to be. And culture is not just about, you know, it's not, you know, platitudes like honesty and integrity and stuff like that. It's, I mean, everyone wants to be honest. Who's going to lie? Like, that's not, it's not a cultural thing that you want to put up. But you want to, what you want to talk about culture in terms of what happens in terms of when there is a crisis, when there is a disagreement. That's what you use the culture for. And I think the underlying tenet for us, for my company at least, has been transparency. Does your team, do you trust your team to do their jobs and for everything else? Does your team trust you? And if the answer is yes in both cases, you've kind of solved a few problems. One, if there is an issue, there is this, you know, baseline trust, and you can go with that, you can sort it out, you at least know what's out there. And then you can start solving the problem. But if there is no trust, if there is no culture of people being like, you know, this person's got my back, then I think you have a fundamental issue. So all of this is true. In addition to that, something that I do take seriously is just being transparent. In my case, everything from how are we doing, how is day to day, all of that stuff, top to bottom, it has to trickle down. We have to do this. And then bottom to top, like, how is every person feeling? Are they happy? Are they coming in? Are they excited to do the job that they're doing? All of that really does matter.
Yeah, I would plus one to trust and transparency. But, you know, right, if you don't create the culture will just happen on its own. And so, you know, having that intention and as the leader, clearly articulating those values of trust and transparency, and then how, again, right, how does that codified, how does trust and transparency actually show up in how people treat each other, how they treat vendors, suppliers, customers, right? And then the other thing, in terms of trickle down and bottom up, every organization that I've ever seen or participated in, at the leader level, the strengths and weaknesses of that leader tend to be replicated throughout the organization. And so the more that you can work on yourself, get an executive coach immediately if you're thinking about starting a company. I know it takes money, but you'll save money, okay, in like not destroying your company or the lives of the people who work there, right? Like do the work on yourself so that then, you know, you're mitigating your weaknesses and you're playing to your strengths, and that will show up, you'll see, in how the company itself functions.
This is so great. So a lot of the conversations that we have on Inflection Point are about leadership style and what it takes to be a great leader and how all of those norms are defined around male leadership attributes, let's just say. So I'm curious if any of you have thought deeply about what it means to be a female leader and what that brings to your company that might be because you are a woman.
I mean, I think that women have, you have to think about also, there's all the stuff obviously of like where women, need to put, act, whether it's like take the seat at the table, whether it's like be willing to apply for the jobs. I mean, all the research that shows that, you know, women aren't willing to take the same risk to apply for a job that a man does. If you're interviewing a woman, like, they're more willing to say, oh, give credit to the group versus like men are be like, I crushed it, you know? And so it's like, you have all of these things that I think that, you know, it's like being self-conscious and being thoughtful about how am I reacting? But I think that the contrary side to that is women maybe stereotype, but often bring more empathy to table, often bring more communication skills to the table. And it's using those things also for your advantage when you're thinking about management and leadership and building that company. And so it shouldn't just be that it's like, okay, here's the places where men have an advantage. Let's also think about the places where we have an advantage and how we use those skills to our advantage.
Yeah, what I've seen is, you know, there are weaknesses, and we've probably all experienced them, weaknesses of, you know, what's considered male leadership, right? But some women do this, you know, where it's oppressive, hierarchical, egotistical, low input, right? Like just a really tough place, you know, highly competitive and ruthless. There are weaknesses to female leadership, you know, too consensus driven, not directive enough, you know, stagnating, you know, way more, too much talking about feelings and not, you know, adhering to the bottom line. So the question is, and men do this too, we've all had male bosses who are like in that, you know, like conflict averse, right? Like won't just address the issue on the table. So, you know, the question is, can you strike to the middle of that, right? Those are two poles. Can you actually achieve a middle ground as much as possible every day in being, you know, directive but not oppressive? You know, can you be, you know, take in input but not be so consensus driven that you just go around in circles without actually deciding?
I guess I'll answer this one by saying I don't think I think about that much. I certainly notice that people notice that I'm a brown woman.
That comes up from time to time.
And that's come up my entire career. And so part of just sort of tactically recognizing that I have to mitigate that so that their beliefs about whatever those beliefs are don't get put on me. Right. So just being very tactical, making sure it's clear that there's a male founder. I think it's mattered as I've met a bunch of people, a bunch of investors. Not because I think men are better or women are better, but because I think people have a narrative in their head. And my goal is to be able to build a company that raises a bunch of money and that makes a bunch of money. And so I guess people have sometimes asked me, what is it like to be a female leader? I mean, I honestly don't know how to answer that question other than I'm trying to build a badass company and build a bunch of people around the table with different perspectives, because oftentimes I was the only one with the female perspective at the table, and I thought that was a disservice. So I don't know if that's me being female or just noticing that I was the other and recognizing that if we had more different perspectives at the table that we could be sharper.
I just think leadership is leadership, yeah. right? I yeah. mean, and we can all recognize right now that we are challenged as a nation yeah. in terms of our leadership, right? I mean, you know, some of you may disagree, but like, okay, right? So we know what bad leadership looks like. You know, sometimes good leadership can be challenging to identify, you know, but the question is, you know, leadership ultimately shows up as being a, you know, what I, the way I run my companies is I am of service. If my team members are feel inspired, if they're nailing it every day, if we're, you know, attracting sales and yes. funding and building hire, you know, and my team has the resources
then
they
you
need
are
to
a badass
that,
leader.
I am yes. I am acting yes. as a good leader.
Yeah.
I think the other aspect, I don't know about the leadership style part, it's not something that I've thought about too, similar to Heather, but one advantage I've had for some reason, well, this is obvious in hindsight, but extraordinary women want to work with other extraordinary women. And so it's been really great for me to hire these great women for my company. And I don't know if it's a leadership style, it's a female leadership style, but I'll take it. You know, this is a great advantage and I'm just exploiting the heck out of it. It's great. But it's really nice to have an awesome team of really good, high quality, high caliber people. And it happens that 75% of our leadership team are women and it's great. We love it. I'll take it. And I don't know if it's a leadership thing, but side effect.
I'm Lauren Schiller. This is Inflection Point at the Women in Product panel I moderated this fall. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast.
So one of the things that has been coming up a lot in the media lately, and I just heard Ellen Pao on the radio this morning talking about her book, recounting her experiences with gender bias, to just put it generally, the flip side of being a female leader and bringing all of these amazing feminine qualities to leadership, which, by the way, I would just like to comment that men should feel free to adopt these leadership styles as well. It doesn't just go one direction or the other. Would anyone like to talk about an experience where they felt like they were just, I don't know, let's just call it on the other side of gender bias, that a decision was made because you were female or because of your skin color, and you were in the moment thinking, am I crazy or did that just happen? Is
yeah.
there a story?
I mean,
you'd like
where
to
do
share?
We start, right?
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot that happens, and most often, to be honest, you kind of let it go because you're like, "Meh, I'm going to pick my battles. This is not one. This is not the thing. Today is not the day. You know, I'm not going to do this." But at some point, it kind of gets to you, and you'll say something, and you're like, "Oh, why did I do that?" But I think one of the first few fundraising pitches for Lumoid, I walk in, and I'm the only founder. I'm an engineer writing the code for it, and also doing customer success. I'm basically doing everything, right? And so I walk in doing this fundraising thing and the investor is like, so who's writing the code for this? I mean, the website looks great. And I'm like, well, you're looking at her. And then he's like, are you sure? And I'm like, how do you answer that? You're like, yes, I'm the one person at the company. So, duh, yes. And he's like, well, okay, I just wanted to check. And I'm like, check what? I already told you. It's very subtle. It's very small. But it's slightly demeaning, and it was meant to be that way too. And you can't really be offended, but it's one of those moments where you're like, did that really happen? How are you supposed to go answer that? And a lot of my experiences have been like very subtle that way. It hasn't been like, you know, a lot of women have come out in recent times and spoken about just outright aggression, stuff like that. Mine have always been these really minor taunts, if you will, insults. And it's always been, am I crazy? Is that okay? But I will tell you that there are a lot of female founders who go through this. And there is a really great, I mean, if you look for it, there are lots and lots of women who've been through this. They will talk to you. There's a great support system. It's kind of RAA, you know? It's like it's this thing that you do where it's like, did that happen to you? Yeah, that happened to me too. And this is the kind of thing that you talk about. And it's fine because, you know, in some cases, it's not meant to be hurtful. they just, it's unconscious bias, whatever you call it. And in some cases, it is spiteful and you kind of call it out and move on. What are you going to do? You have to fundraise, you have to build the company. And I'll, you know, there's one part which is just principled. I'm never going to take money from this person. And then there's the other extreme where you're like, just be a pragmatist. Just fine. Just do it. And so you kind of find the balance there and you kind of pick your battles and you move on. But there are a lot of things that happen like this.
Yeah, no, those things, I mean, raise your hand if something weird in the workplace has happened to you. Okay, yeah, like this is,
Everyone's raising their hand.
Universal, I think, experience, unfortunately, as women. Hopefully our daughters and sons will experience a different world, and we're part of building that world, you know, but at the same time, you know, I think that, in terms of running a startup, I knew that big New York Times expose that came out. I actually knew two people on both sides, a funder, you know, a VC, and, you know, someone who had been victimized by a VC. So it was a very surreal article for me to read. You guys probably know the New York Times article I'm talking about. You know, look, do not take bad money. A guy who wants to give you money for your company and is expecting to get in your pants as a result is not good money. And here's why. Just taking away like the disgustingness of that behavior, like just like put that to the side. Just put it to the side. That person is not making rational decisions. This is a person who is willing to distort business decisions in pursuit of frivolous pursuits. And therefore, this is not a person who can be a good advisor. This isn't a business person that you want to get into bed with for a lot of different reasons. You know, it's worth...
Literally or figuratively,
it is worth knocking on a few extra doors to find that investor who believes in you and sees you as a sentient human being worthy of respect rather than a means to an end. Because that person is therefore going to be a much better advisor, you know, a much better advocate for you with other funders, you know, someone who will, you know, show up, you know, when it's hard, you know, when in the funding process, that first money, you know, that investor probably is going to have to stay and invest again and again to make sure that you get through. So, you know, is that person really going to stick around after you stop putting out, right? Like, it's just bad money. It's just bad. Like, don't take it.
Yeah, I mean, and it seems like what you're creating is a totally unequal power dynamic from the very beginning. And I would imagine that the reason that most people would be interested in starting their own company is because you would like to be the one in charge. And I understand that that's not always the case as you get down the road because there's other people involved who have a stake in it. But at the end of the day, you're compromising the very reason you started out in the first place. I mean, does that sound about right?
Can I add one thing? Yeah. Definitely don't put out. I totally agree.
Just don't do it. Don't do that.
But I will say, I mean, almost everyone raised their hand. Something weird happened. I guess my counsel on this is, or I guess the way I've handled it is just being mindful that when the expectation is low, it's really easy to blow it out of the water, you know, and just to share a funny story on that one, you know, at my last company, Trulia, you know, it was our first ever investor day and I was going to present in front of all the analysts. And just the executives were in the room and we're chit-chatting with all of the analysts. And I'm talking to one and I'm nervous because I'm presenting on the core business, right? 80% of Trulia's revenue was subscription services to real estate agents. And that was my business. I was the GM of that, owned the P&L. And I'd been warned, right? Be careful because people are going to try and get all the data from you that we're not sharing in the formal presentation. So I was like fully equipped, like with my one-liners and trying to deflect. So I'm talking to this guy and I'm waiting for it. I won't disclose what bank he was at. And so he's like, so are you on the customer service team? And I was like, sort of, you know, like I run the customer service team and the sales team and the product team and the marketing team for the core business. Bye. And then I went to go present and it was great. Because at the end, you know, I think my decision matrix on this one is you can let it bother you, and I have over time, or I can say, like, you have those expectations for whatever reason and your experiences, and I don't think you're a bad person, and now I'm going to blow this shit out of the water, and it's going to be awesome. So that's my approach.
to piggyback off that, we used to go do M&A when I was in Europe, and we go to different countries, and that my head of tech ops was this like middle-aged white guy. And so everybody used to assume he was my boss. And so we started making it a game. So we would walk in and like figure out how long it would take them to realize I was the decision maker. You know, they'd be like, sir, can we get you coffee? And like it would just go on. And then ultimately, like at some point, he'd be like, oh, I don't know. You have to ask my boss that question. And you would see like the color drain. And you're just like, and so, I mean, it is that thing where, you know, yes, sometimes you have to have a thick skin. Sometimes you have to just power through. And I'm not saying that, like, if there is sexual harassment, that is unacceptable and you have to report it. Like, there is no question. But I think there is this balance of, like, as you're going through your careers, shit will happen. And there's a point of, like, some cases you have to let it be water off a duck's back and move on.
Yeah, I mean, haters are going to hate. I mean, you just... You know, and you can focus on. Did I finally get you, Selena? I finally got you.
Everybody.
You know, you can focus on the people. You can focus on the haters and the people who, like, for whatever reason, just can't cope with like your femaleness or your brownness or both. Or you can, you know, to me, you know, like a moth to the flame. Like, I just focus on the people who believe in me and are really excited to work with me and excited about the vision. You know, like just, you know, I just focus on that, and like the rest of it is just noise. For me,
we are almost at the end of our session, and several of you have submitted questions through Slido, and we unfortunately are not going to be able to get to all of them. But I hope that we've gotten to some of them just through the course of this conversation. So the last question that I would like to have each of you answer, if you would like to impart your wisdom, is. It seems to me that being an entrepreneur and having a startup mentality. And being a CEO and running a company are two totally different skill sets. That's my impression, but maybe I am wrong. And I'm wondering if, as you go through your process of growing and changing beyond the initial ideation stage, how have you made that transition, and what has worked successfully for you?
I mean, I guess I've gone slightly the opposite in the sense that I was like, we both have kind of gone the opposite. We
right,
were so like running big teams, and like now suddenly you're the entrepreneur. I mean, I think the biggest thing in general, like, you know, when I started at SurveyMonkey, we were 20. I left, we were a few hundred, grew it from 20 to 200 million. Like the process of scaling, which I think is what you're questioning. Like when you're starting off with, as Heather mentioned, when you're starting off irrelevant, then you're growing. I mean, the biggest things from my perspective are, number one is that hiring great people and empowering them to succeed, and how you're empowering them to succeed is making sure that you're setting up what are the metrics for success? Like, what do you want to see? And making sure that they have the resources and ability to achieve that. Because like one of the things of setting up that sort of is giving them access to the data, the metrics, and all the information you can, and then letting people run with it, letting people succeed or fail. And if they fail, that's okay. But making sure that they learn from it and keep going. And so I think that as you're scaling, it's like you as an individual have to be very comfortable that your knowledge of every situation is going to be less and less, because you can't obviously be in the details of everything. And it's your job to provide those frameworks for others to succeed.
And let me add another element to the question, which is in the spirit of passing along wisdom. What's the best advice that you've ever been given about how to do that? About how to let go a little.
So for me, again, it was Dave, but he actually told me at that point in my career, he said, like, join a board, because it forces you to make decisions that are at a strategic level and not a detail level. So again, in my mind, it may not be joining a board. I mean, if you can, whether it's a nonprofit board or a company board, you should definitely try. But it's putting yourselves in some situation, and it doesn't have to be at your company, but where you're being forced or thinking about having to make decisions without all of that detail. And so it's putting yourselves in that and getting practice at that.
Yeah. I think what's been really helpful, and again, total honesty, I didn't really do a lot of this when I switched from the founder mode to a CEO mode. I learned a lot of things, made a bunch of mistakes. I think the switch in your head flips when you hire that first employee, because now that person is dependent on you to make sure that the company does well, as much as you're dependent on that person. It's this mutual relationship thing. And, you know, first few days were really hard. Fundraising was brutal. It took us 8 months to close our first seed round. It was completely insane. There were days we were like, we are completely crazy to be doing this and we should just give up. And it was almost this thing which kept us going, because everyone said no and we're like, no, we have to do this. And that kind of fueled us. I think for us, one of the things that's worked is just never accept no for an answer. We just never do. I think everybody in the company is as boneheaded as I am, which is just, we're just persistent as hell. And that has worked out really, really well. The other thing that I've since learned and have done a reasonable job of is to surround myself with similar-minded people. Good advisors, good board. The counterpoint to what Selena said is, as she's joining a board, I get people on my board who are really good. I have advisors who are fantastic. And that's the only way you're going to survive this, because you need to go through this with people who've done this or in a similar mindset as you are. And if you're not in that space, it gets a lot harder.
I would say from my perspective, it's actually easier to scale than to start. Because starting is so fun. It's creation. Everything is opportunity. And yet, as Selena just said, you're totally irrelevant. And so fighting for relevance and keeping your personal enthusiasm and fire and passion high when the data is telling you that things aren't working is sometimes fun and sometimes totally horrible. So, you know, that transition, at least from my perspective, you know, scaling is much easier, right? And the best advice that I got on this is hire your replacement, right? So as a founder or entrepreneur, you're doing lots of things and you get used to the things that you're really good at. But the reality is there's someone out there who's probably better. And so you hire someone who's better than you at that, and then you can build the next part of it. Because as a founder entrepreneur, I sort of have that energy to do a little bit of everything. And then you can, you know, hire the people who just sort of scale your org for you. And maybe that's why I think it's easier, because there are so many talented people out there. You just have to be willing to let go of the reins and let them do their job.
I'm going to talk about something totally different but related, which is, you know, in the course of scaling, your business is growing. Life is going to happen. So for my business partner actually had two children during the course of our was pregnant twice and had a baby during our startup. And I was pregnant and we were actually, the company was acquired in July 2016. And I had my child, my baby, in August 2017. So I was hella pregnant. Like going into these M&A, being like, yeah, okay, let's talk about, you know, acquiring my awesome boss company. It's a challenge, right? Like it's, you know, as women, we have an extra, like most men are not going to not going to be showing up visibly having a major life change in the middle of scaling their company, right? Like that's just not a thing they have to deal with. And what I would tell you is having a baby during your startup is crazy. But you know, most of us are in our peak reproductive years. It might happen, and that's okay. Like you are allowed to be a human being, and don't apologize for it. So we, you know, like one, just to, you know, wrap it up, you know, my business partner and I had to pitch at Venture Atlanta. So there are going to be, you know, like 300 different angels and VCs in this room. And she was like 8 months pregnant. I mean, so she was like, it was a lot. And she was feeling weird about going up on this big stage, you know, to pitch our company for a Series A because we were trying to scale. Her husband had to just, so it was, the event was happening in the Atlanta Aquarium. And so there were these white beluga whales swimming. And so she was going to make a joke. Her husband had suggested making a joke about the whales and her size.
That's a horrible idea.
No, right. Absolutely. I was like, absolutely not. Not on my watch. No. Like 90% of those dudes in that room would never have the courage to do what you're about to do. You don't have the right to make fun of yourself because you're like crushing it. Like you're doing something unbelievable that is inhuman. Here's what you say. You say you've got two startups, okay? One of which has a 20-year runway, Okay, and the other is Attentively, a marketing automation social listening tool that is transforming nonprofits around the world. Dagnabbit. Okay? Right. So don't apologize for who you are. Don't apologize for being a woman, for being brown. Don't apologize for your ideas. Your ideas are valid and deserve funding because only you can solve the problems that are unsolved in America and around the world.
Thank you.
First of all, I just love the live format. Being back here in the studio and listening back to that conversation was so fun. These are seriously badass women. And I want to give Women in Product a big hand for bringing these women together to learn from each other and to collaborate with each other. My understanding is that they had 5 times the turnout from their first gathering, somewhere around 1,500 women. I think they've tapped into a need here. With more women solving more problems from health to fitness to how we buy to how we drive social change, I'm feeling good about our future. And believe me, I know these are tough times to say that kind of thing. This is Inflection Point. I'm Lauren Schiller with stories of how women rise up. That's our Inflection Point for today. Know a woman with a great rising up story? Let us know at inflectionpointradio.org. While you're there, I invite you to become a patron of Inflection Point. Inflection Point is brought to you in partnership with KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco and PRX. You can find our podcast on iTunes, Radio Public, and NPR One. Give us a 5-star review. We'd love that. Our story editor and content manager is Alora Weaver. Our engineer and producer is Eric Wayne. And I'm your host, Lauren Schiller.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
From PRX.